Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Tomorrow is National HIV Testing Day. The purpose of that day is to encourage everyone to get tested and to know their HIV status. During this program, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about who is at risk, how to get tested if you are at risk, and much more on this, our yearly HIV AIDS update program. With me today are Matt Allen. He's on my right. I'm sure you can see him on your TV sets. I have no idea why I said that. He is the Prevention Education Coordinator at the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association. And also with us from the AIDS Assistance Association is Heather Davis, who is the Executive Director. And our medical expert today is Terry Brammel. She is the clinical specialist and the director of the Ryan Wyatt White Program for HIV and AIDS at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
Matt, thanks for coming for your first appearance.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I hope to see you back every year for 40 or 50 years. Well, actually, I don't. Hopefully, we won't have this problem.
Yeah.
40 or 50 years. All right. So let's do the basics. Let's talk about the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association first. Heather, you want to tell us about that?
Sure. So we have been here in Alaska almost since the beginning of the epidemic. We've had our nonprofit for 32 years now. The main part of what we do is provide services for people living with or affected by HIV and AIDS and their family members. And then we do prevention activities and outreach, which includes rapid HIV testing and rapid Hep C testing. And then we also run the 4-H syringe access program, which provides sterile needles and supplies to people who are injecting drugs. And we have an office here in Anchorage, our main office, and we also have an office in Juneau, which does everything we do in Anchorage on a much smaller basis.
And Matt, says you're the prevention and education coordinator. Tell us a little bit about what you do every day.
So it's basically doing a lot of outreach, HIV testing, Hep C testing, and education in the community, and as well as our 4-H syringe access program, or FASAP, we'll call it, and just running that, which is ever expanding. But so that's kind of my daily routine.
Where do you do your education? Is it something you're doing at the association, or you go out and even flying around? Is that what's happening?
So, yeah, we do a lot of it as what we get walk-ins for testing. And then we partner up with different communities, agencies, and with Rural Cap and some treatment centers to do education and testing as well.
And Terry, what are the resources ANTHE that you, and what do you do there?
Well, we have a Ryan White Part C program. We provide clinical services for Alaska Native beneficiaries at the internal medicine clinic at ANMC, as well as field clinics and some non-beneficiary clinics in Fairbanks. We also provide consultation to providers across the state to help co-manage HIV patients in their home area, because we have a little more expertise than the average primary care provider in terms of choosing medications, et cetera. And we're also part of the Mountain West AIDS Education and Training Center, so we provide provider education around the state on HIV/AIDS related issues.
Let me remind listeners that if you have questions or comments, if you're in Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1, and you spell that out, all one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. Heather, before it leaves me, why don't we tell listeners how to get in contact with you?
Sure. They can call our office at 907-263-2050. And then we also have a website, www.alaskan.org. And there's a lot of information on our website.
And we have that link on our personal, the Alaska Public Media website. If you go to alaskapublic.org and you go to the Line One link, you'll see a link to the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association, as well as AENTHC's information and some other sites for more information if you would like that information. And we thought about before the program, who else can people turn to? Who else in the community, at least in the local Anchorage area, is caring for individuals with AIDS in particular? I guess I'll structure it like that. Then we'll talk about testing, which is a slightly different issue. But if you have AIDS, you think you've got HIV, you want to see a specialist, and you're not an Alaska native, and you wanted to go into the see a physician, let's say, or a practitioner, where would they go?
So we partner not only with AANTHC, but also with Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center. We have several clients there, and then we work really closely with Dr. Wesley and Dr. Clancy, who are both based here in Anchorage. And Hope McGrady works with Dr. Wesley's office, and she's a wonderful resource for us with our HIV and Hep C clients.
So why do we have to have a national HIV testing day? Who wants to tackle that question?
Well, 1 in 7 people who have HIV don't know that they have HIV. So there is a big push by the CDC for all people to know their status. The recommendation is anyone from age 13 to 65. I'm not sure why there's a cap on the 65 end of it. But yeah, there are approximately 1 in 7 is what they assume do not have, do not know their status. And it's really important for people to know their status, because the sooner they get on treatment and get virally suppressed, the healthier they'll be and be able to live a longer life, and they decrease the risk of infecting other people.
Matt, Heather said virally suppressed. What in the heck is she talking about? What does that mean?
So that would be, getting on a regimen to where they're at the point of being undetectable, which really lowers the risk of transmitting the disease to others, improves their health as well. So that's what that would mean.
So it appears to me that if you know your status, then you can direct not only to protect yourself, but protect others. Mm-hmm. And as Terry Bramble said before we went on the air, probably the most important thing that we as people trying to educate the public need to do is to keep reminding people to get tested. Is that, mm-hmm. that the key message?
Yes. Everybody should have at least a baseline test, and then if there's ongoing risk, which may be as simple as having sex with your husband in some cases, they should be tested periodically. High risk should be tested at least every year. Every 5 years is not unreasonable. Some organizations have gone to that just in terms of tracking to make sure people have a test.
So basically, from a public health standpoint, what I hear you saying is the better individuals know how their status, the better we can identify them, the better we can offer treatment, the better we can prevent transmission, as well as take care of them a little bit better.
Right. If they are virally suppressed on antiretrovirals, the risk of them transmitting is very, very small. Less than 1% if they're continuing on their medications reliably.
So what's an antiretroviral, since you brought it up?
It is the medications we use to treat HIV, to keep it from reproducing in the body. And in general, we use at least 3 antiretrovirals in a regimen to sort of hit the virus from different mm-hmm. points in its life cycle.
So a virus is different than a bacteria, but we have begun to develop antiviral medications like we have antibiotics. So an antiretroviral is a penicillin, so to speak, for the HIV virus specifically.
Right.
Versus penicillin for strep, right?
But at this point, we cannot cure the virus. We can treat it and keep it suppressed.
So why is that?
It's a tricky virus, and it mutates a lot. Yeah. The main reason, though, is that there's resting virus in the tissues of the body that the medications don't really get at. They work when the virus is replicating, so when it's just resting, the medicine isn't really doing anything. So the current research is how do we flush out that resting virus? To treat it.
So viruses are different than bacteria in the sense that they kind of take over our cells and inject their own genetic material into our genetic material, which makes it, they hijack it and then use our cells to manufacture what they need to continue to infect other cells and other people. And so that gets a little bit more difficult, and one of the reasons why antiviral treatment in general for colds, for herpes, mm-hmm. for hepatitis C, which we now have some very good treatment, has been much, much slower to develop than penicillin, which has been around, I think I'm going to say, through the 40s. Hopefully nobody calls me on that one. It's somewhere in there. We had sulfa antibiotics during World War II, I know, at the beginning, and maybe, so I'm not sure exactly when penicillin was really commercially produced and began to be useful. So why is it called, the illness, AIDS, called acquired immunodeficiency syndrome? Where does that take us with understanding this problem?
Well, when somebody has HIV, it predominantly attacks immune system cells, the CD4 cells in particular. And so the immune system over time, if not treated, becomes less and less functional, and people become susceptible to all kinds of opportunistic infections. However, in this day and age with the antiretroviral treatment, there's no reason somebody should develop AIDS as a result of having the virus if we have them in care and well treated.
So what I heard you say is, putting this analogy back, if it's a cold virus, it's hijacking cells, it kind of hijacks the respiratory mucosa and makes us have congestion and maybe a little bit of some fever and aches and pains. But the HIV virus hijacks some of our immune cells that are protecting us. And as those things get destroyed, we start becoming much more susceptible. And that's what generally does us in, is my understanding, is these infections later as your immune system is affected. But I also heard you say that now, with current management, that should not happen.
No, that should not happen. And now the challenge is that we have a lot of people with HIV aging, and we have to deal with heart disease and all the other diseases that people didn't used to live long enough to get. Right. So correct. Once we have their virus under control, we have a whole nother challenge of keeping them healthy.
And with treatment, they become less contagious to others.
Yes, very much so.
If they take their medication. So what is the typical protocol for taking? How many tablets? How many medications? How many days a week? How long?
These days, it's still an everyday medication. It could be as simple as one pill a day. There are a lot of reasons it could get more complex, but most people are on one to three pills a day, once a day, with fairly low side effects.
All right. Human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, how is that transmitted from people, person to person?
So through body fluids. So there's the four main fluids, which would include blood, vaginal and anal fluids, semen, and even breast milk.
Do you know off the top of your head, since you brought up breast milk, and I know that's a reasonable thing to think about, how often that happens? Is that a common mode of transmission, or is anybody, you know that off the top of your head?
I think it's pretty low, especially if, you know, the mother knows ahead of time, and they can provide treatment. But Terry might have a better answer for that.
I believe it's about 12 to 14% transmission in an untreated mother. In our country, we recommend mothers with HIV do not breastfeed.
Right, right.
In other countries, that's really not a viable option.
What about once you're treated? Let's say you have a mother who knows she's HIV, is taking treatment, has very good viral suppression, gets pregnant, delivers a child. One, we're going to see if that child's got HIV, but the likelihood, I guess, is low.
Less than 1%.
If they're treated. And then what's the risk breastfeeding of transmission?
You know, we don't really know those numbers because we do not do studies in pregnant women or in breastfeeding women to see what the risk is. We just recommend they don't breastfeed.
Okay. Let me remind listeners once again, this is a program discussing HIV and AIDS. It's kind of a, what we're beginning to call our yearly update, since I'm meeting Heather and Terry regularly. And this is Matt Allen, who is our third guest today. This is our first time for meeting him. But it's something that we're going to be doing or have been doing yearly. If you've got questions or comments, you can call us right now at 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433, a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Another bit of information I love to talk about is the epidemiology. That means the who, what, when, where, how kind of a problem. It doesn't necessarily give us cause and effect, but it leads to a lot better understanding of where we need to be doing research and addressing treatment. So who wants to kind of tell us what's happening nationally and locally as best we can with AIDS and HIV numbers?
Well, we were seeing about 50,000 people who are newly diagnosed every year. I know I was looking up most recent statistics, and in 2015, it actually declined by about 18%. There are approximately 40,000 people diagnosed
in
2015.
That's U.S.-wide.
That's U.S.-wide, yeah. These aren't international statistics. So the rate did go down. We're still seeing about 55% of new cases in young men and men. Mm-hmm. The biggest increase is with the Black and African American population right now.
So what I hear you saying is that the highest risk population still is men, mm-hmm. particularly Black men who may have sex with men, but that means there's another large 50% of that. What'd you say, 45,000 new cases?
About 40,000 new cases in 2015, yeah.
That are not in that particularly high-risk category. So how can we look at that group?
So it's broken down further with the next largest group is Hispanic Latino. Also men, again, the primary cases are still in men across the United States. And then it breaks down further from there.
What's the Alaskan story, as far as we can tell? Are we seeing similar drops in the new cases?
Well, I think it's been staying somewhat even. There's a few spikes and drops. In 2016, we had 38 newly diagnosed cases. And then, of course, they'll take into account individuals that moved to Alaska that are already positive. But we've had 38 new cases in 2016.
What about blood transfusions? It's my understanding that the transmission of HIV from blood transfusion is extremely small. But I'm wondering if the general public understands that. Am I right, and what do we know?
Well, in 1985, I think they really started to change their practices on whenever it came to blood transfusions, making sure that it wasn't infected blood. But I, you know, for numbers on that, I'm not quite certain, but I think it's pretty low.
It's extremely low because of screening of people who donate blood, as well as the more sensitive tests that can detect infection much earlier. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely safe.
And the blood
safe.
Itself is screened.
Yes.
Yes.
As
yes.
well. Okay. So what about needle stick exposures? Again, this is a health care question in particular for nurses, physicians, doing surgery, during surgery, taking care of patients. Just needle stick exposures, maybe cuts exposures. Is that a relatively common way, or still a very, very uncommon way of exposure?
It's very uncommon. There haven't been any documented cases in years, and mm-hmm. overall, there's not been a lot. Under 200, I think. Yeah. If somebody is exposed to HIV through a needle stick or cut, say in the medical setting, they can take a medication for 28 days that will lower the risk even more of them acquiring the virus.
So maybe we should move on to testing. We want to encourage testing. So how can someone get tested?
It's really easy. Our office offers testing every day, Monday through Friday from 9 to 5 o'clock. And then tomorrow I'll let Matt talk about, because it's HIV testing day, what's going on around the Anchorage community. But also what we offer is a rapid test. So people actually come in, get tested, and know their results within 20 minutes, which makes it really quick and easy for them and not so scary, I think.
Yeah. So tomorrow we're actually extending our hours. We'll be open at 7:30 at the 4A's. And then we'll also be doing testing at the Mountain View Library from 11 to 2. And the municipality is doing extended hours, which can be found on their website.
And we can get you your website. We've already said that through by looking up the 4A's of Alaska. You can get through our website. And do they need to make appointments? They just show up?
Just walk in, yeah.
Cost?
It's free. Yeah, it's no free, charge. Yeah.
All right. Confidentiality, privacy. That's another concern that families or individuals
sure.
might have.
Well, so it is confidential, not anonymous. Of course, we do have to collect some information. We report to the CDC so that they can collect all those phone numbers. But it is confidential. testing.
You said that you give the phone numbers to the CDC. That's going to cause some concern. Why is that happening?
No, so we'll just give the basic demographic information to them.
No, phone numbers.
No specific.
Won't be getting calls.
Okay. Yeah.
However, if we do have a preliminary positive, then we have to get a confirmatory test. And then, of course, if they're positive, we have to notify the state. It's a reportable condition. Mm-hmm.
And why is that? Why would the state be notified?
Because
They would like to know what who's being positive, who's coming up positive, and then it's also a way for a linkage to care too, so they don't slip through the cracks.
Yeah. And they will try to find out who their partners are, right. So we can be sure mm-hmm. we're covering everyone.
There's an effort to try to one of the reasons it's reportable is so that we can try to control
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Terry, how about at ANMC if a native wants to get tested and they don't want to do it this other way? Are there places at your place?
There's not any special testing clinic. However, they could always see us or just ask their primary care provider for a test, or if they go into urgent care, ask for a test. And sometimes they need to be a little bit proactive about that, because we still will have providers saying, oh, you don't need a test, you're not at risk. And
I still think there's that education of right. Physicians as well. You know, the CDC recommendation is everybody get tested once a year, but yet I don't think most physicians, you know, when their patients come in, actually ask them, have you ever been tested for mm-hmm. HIV? What are your risk factors?
And increasingly people are having prompts in their electronic health record.
Right.
Have you ever, right. So that you can think about it, because, providers have so many other things to think about. HIV is not always high on their list.
Yeah, and certainly they, as you've implied, people can go to their primary care physicians. They can go to the emergency room, although that's, an expensive way to go about it. And it can be tested for free, as you said, at your organization, the Alaska mm-hmm. AIDS Assistance Association. There's another point that was on my mind about this. It's something to do with the confidentiality issue. I might just comment on, so that people can understand what the legal obligations are from a provider standpoint. If someone comes to me and admits that wants to be tested, I cannot talk about that with anybody else without their permission. It is a reportable problem. I have to report that, however, for investigation purposes. But I can't share it with a spouse. I can't a young child or an older child, a teenager. I can't share it with the parents. So there is some, I'm not sure everybody understands that that aspect of being a physician and a healthcare provider. All right. I think this is a good time to take our normal kind of one-minute break. So I want to remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. Our local number, 550-8433. 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a one-minute break and continue to discuss HIV and AIDS. We'll get into treatment and prevention a little bit more with Terry Brammel, Harry Davis, Heather Davis, and Matt Allen. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Terry Brammel. She is the director of the ANTHC Ryan White program here in Anchorage. Heather Davis is with me as well. She's executive director of the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association, and Matt Allen is also here. He's the prevention and education coordinator of the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association. Over the break, we've talked briefly, and we forgot to mention one very important group of individuals who are at risk of acquiring AIDS, and also probably they're at risk of not knowing their status and at risk of spreading that to others who may not be aware that they are being exposed, and that is injection drug users. What do we know about this group, and is this becoming a bigger problem, a less problem? If it's becoming a less problem, why is it becoming a less problem?
So it's definitely becoming more of a problem, just with the opioid epidemic that's going on everywhere. Alaska Anchorage is seeing it as well, and through exchange, we're seeing increased numbers, and with each individual that comes in, there's always the option for them to get tested for HIV and Hep C. We offer that, and so I think it's definitely a problem. It's an issue.
Are we able to separate out whether the problem is increasing because of the use of opioids or because the exchange program is failing to live up to its billing?
Well, we're not in Alaska. We're not.
Not yeah.
We have not seen an outbreak in IV drug users. It's the potentials that's there. I think the syringe exchange offers an extremely valuable service.
Well, that's what I was hoping you were going to say, and that's why I threw it out there. I didn't want the public to misunderstand why we were seeing it. And my understanding is that it's an extremely valuable and cost-effective way to help.
Right, because one of the ways that the risk is increased is when injection drug users share their needles. So the whole purpose of having a syringe exchange is for people to use a clean needle each and every time, right, which decreases the risk of passing along HIV or Hep C or any other infectious diseases. So it plays a vital role in preventing big public health outbreaks of this type of thing. So hopefully the syringe exchange is serving that purpose. But as Matt said, it's a growing problem. One day last week, we had 160 people come through our syringe exchange in one day. That's a lot of people. So,
yeah, it's definitely an opportunity to be able to educate as well. Mm-hmm. This is a high-risk group. but not just for needle use, just being using a substance as well, poor decision making, not using condoms. So being able to have kind of a one-on-one with everyone that comes in is a great way to educate on those issues.
It's also a good way to connect them with treatment resources mm-hmm. and other resources.
Absolutely.
I think there's a general misunderstanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that the individuals who are into this IV drug use are somehow different than the rest of us. And it's no different than anybody else. Any of us could get into this trap sometimes.
Yeah.
People don't understand that. It's as if there's some failing with these individuals. Matt, do you want to address that? I didn't want to set you up for that, but it's something I think is important for people to understand.
It is. There's still that stigma that's associated. I think it was an eye-opener for me to really start working at the exchange just this past year. I've learned a lot, and it's anyone is affected. It doesn't discriminate. Whether, it's from started as a child, childhood trauma, or it was just from an accident that, they got on opiates and then they slowly went into injecting, which is a large part of that population is kind of what happens.
And I don't think people realize, the high numbers that actually come from being prescribed an opioid and then, the prescription runs out or they can't get the prescription. But there is already that addiction to it. So then they turn to other ways.
Hopefully we're getting a little bit better handle with all the education about chronic pain and pain management. We've talked about those programs, about this in the past. And if anybody would like to get more information about the appropriateness use of pain medications, you can go to alaskapublic.org, find the Line 1 link. You'll see our archives, and there's definitely a program or two that really gets into this in some depth. We're talking about HIV and AIDS. Those of you who are listening who have questions or comments, I'm going to give you some contact number again. Locally, 550-8433, 550-8433. Toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Terry, let's talk about some ways that we haven't really talked about in great depth so far about preventing transmission to individuals who may not already be infected from someone who is, and then and other kind of preventative things. There's the PrEP and the PEP system. What are we talking about here?
Okay, well, still the number one way to prevent transmission is to have the HIV-positive person treated and virally suppressed.
And knowing their status
so that they can be on meds.
Right.
There is pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is a daily pill that somebody at high risk can take to help prevent acquisition, and it's about 90% effective if they take it every day. Along with that comes regular medical monitoring and education opportunities, screening for other sexually transmitted diseases, and encouragement of condom use and other preventive measures. So it really is effective, both from the medication standpoint and from the behavioral intervention standpoint, and catching people early before they spread it to many other people.
So in what situation would the pre-exposure, which individuals, who would be candidates in that situation?
So men who have sex with men are one. IV drug users are another. Anybody who has an HIV-positive partner. Anybody who trades sex for drugs or money.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the primary groups.
High risk.
And the thought is that these risk behaviors don't go on for life, but if we can get people through high-risk periods until maybe they mature a little and start making healthier choices, that we can prevent new infections.
So I'm assuming if someone comes in for testing that some of that education goes on at the same time?
Oh, yeah. The way testing works at the 4A's, they'll fill out the paperwork. And then during the, while the test is, we're waiting for the results to come in, we have a private conversation in our testing room, a counseling session. We talk about the risks. And go through kind of the risk factors. And then it's just kind of a relaxed conversation. We can talk about ways to lower those risks. We can get them condoms and lubricant if that's something that is preventing them from having safer sex. And then we do discuss PrEP as well.
We have a phone call. Let's go ahead and take that. Dorothy, you're on line one.
Yes, this is Dorothy. I'm calling from the village, and my question is, there's a lot of Alaska Natives with substance abuse and everything, and you know how they end up, and I haven't seen any percentage of how many people are affected.
Okay.
Is it because they scared to get tested or...
All right. Good question, Dorothy. So, Terry, what do we know about the Native population? You know, what we said 1 in 7 in the United States don't know that they're positive. How does that relate to Alaskan Natives if we know that? And
well, we don't know what we don't know. So we don't know about the people that haven't been tested. But we do know in 2016 that of the new diagnoses in Alaska, 45% of them were Alaska Native. So it's really disproportionate. Anywhere you go in the world, it's disproportionate in the ethnic and racial minorities and marginalized groups of people. So we continue to encourage testing so that we can get those people into care.
Okay, so everybody's scared to get tested because they don't want to know their...
There's a lot of people that are scared. A lot of people still think this is a death sentence like it was in the early days, and that's no longer true. But there's also a lot of moral judgment around people that are infected with HIV and whatever lifestyle choices they made or didn't make. It really doesn't matter how they got it, but both communities and families and medical providers can be very judgmental. And so I've seen people who would really rather die than get into care and risk anybody knowing they have HIV. And this is a medical issue.
Yeah.
It's not a moral issue.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Okay, 45%. Okay. Thank you very much.
45% of new cases in Alaska is what I heard Terry say are Alaska Native in origin.
Yes. And that goes up and down by year, but it has trended upwards since I've been doing this for 15 years.
Yeah, one thing
years.
I would say about statistics is this is a small state,
right.
not a lot of cases each year, new ones. So a couple of new ones can really make that percentage sound bad. But it's a significant issue in the Native population, it should be said, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Dorothy. I feel a need to talk about this issue now a little bit about why some people are at greater risk and why they may be felt to be having problems. We now know that very early in life significant traumas lead people to have behaviors often for a very long portion of their life that would lead them to respond in a dangerous matter, drinking, sex, alcohol, drug exposure. And so early childhood traumas can cause people to act differently, and that can cause long-term behavior changes, which can affect their health and their length of life. We've talked about that on the show many times. The other issue is sexual preference. I don't know that for a fact, but I am pretty sure that sexual preference has a huge genetic component and is therefore also out of our control. Do you guys, what do you all have to say about that? Do you believe that? Do you think that's different? And so what I'm getting at is some things are controllable and some things are not controllable.
Well, I firmly believe that there's a genetic component because I don't think people would choose the difficult
good point.
The difficulty of identifying as homosexual, for instance. And I also think that...
And that may be why we're seeing more of it, more acknowledgement of it, is becoming a little bit more accepting from a cultural standpoint. But there's no reason to think that we're seeing more of what is culturally in this country accepted as different sexual preference.
I think it's been documented through ancient times.
Yeah.
That there were different sexual preferences.
But
and
what we're saying
identities.
Is those individuals with those preferences feel different and are ostracized and it's dangerous to themselves. It's hard for them to come out and talk about that. And therefore, again, that affects them psychologically, affects what they do, affects their stress, their anxiety, their behavior.
I think a couple other factors, too, is that in Alaska, we have extremely high rates of other STIs. We've seen huge jumps in the gonorrhea rates. This year, the rate of gonorrhea is 57% higher than the first quarter of last year. And we'll probably be number three in the nation. And for the last 10 years, we've been number one in chlamydia rates. So those other STIs greatly increase the risk of either acquiring or transmitting HIV. And as well, it's a little bit of Russian roulette. You don't know, you know, when it's going to be transmitted. And frankly, all of us have done things in our lifetime that were not the healthiest choice.
Sure.
And they didn't have life-altering consequences, but they potentially could have. So in terms of judging people for their behaviors, some of us have been lucky.
Absolutely true. Let me remind listeners maybe one more time. This is Line 1, your health connection. If you've got questions about HIV or AIDS, our number 550-8433, 550-8433, our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Terry, let's talk some more about this pre-exposure. What is it? What is pre-exposure? Is it a tablet? Is it a vaccine? When do you take it? And how long do you take it?
Okay. There's only one medication approved at this point, and it's a combination of two antiretrovirals. We also use them in treating HIV. And the idea is that you take it every day, and the levels in your tissues build up over a week to a month, so that if you are exposed to the virus, your body can fight it off before it actually takes hold and infects you. And when we prescribe it, we usually prescribe 30 days worth, have people come back. We want to make sure that they don't already have HIV and that we're under-treating them. We also want to make sure that they don't have hepatitis B, because we use these same medications to treat hepatitis B, so we need to be aware of that. And then we monitor kidney function. So once we get through the first 30 days, this isn't an ideal case, then we redo the testing and prescribe 90 days at a time, so that people are coming in every 3 months for HIV screening, other STI screening, and every 6 months or so monitoring their renal function, their kidney function.
So I'm sure listeners out there wondering, is this safe? How do you answer that question?
It's believed to be safe. We've had people with HIV on these medications for many, many years. Of course, these medications have only been around for, you know, say 20 years or so, these particular ones. And so we never know what might happen after 40, 50 years. But the hope is that people will only be on these for a few years until their circumstances change and they're no longer at such high risk.
And I'm always quick to point out to listeners, it's not just a question, is the treatment safe? You have to ask yourself, what's the risk of not taking the treatment? Mm-hmm. And in this situation,
the disease is far
to be a pretty,
worse
pretty
than
bad the side effect in general.
And with PrEP, and just with PrEP, you know, if you take it daily, it's very effective. But if you don't stick to that regimen, it becomes less effective.
Okay. Good point.
So it's important to, you know, follow those recommendations. We've been, even for testing, I've been getting into the habit of telling people to put on their calendar on their phone, you know, in 3 months, come back, get tested. So it's important to keep those reminders, especially whenever you're talking about a medication like that.
And the side effects we've seen from this medication are pretty minimal. If there are any, it's usually a little nausea or GI side effects that go away in a few weeks to a month.
All right, let me talk about cost. In our country now, cost is an issue for everybody. We have higher deductibles. We have co-pays. Things get expensive. How expensive is this? How much do you guys think that prevents people from using it? And how can people get help to pay for it if they want to use it or need to?
Well, I do know Gilead, the maker of Truvada, they provide...
Truvada is this
antiretroviral?
Yeah, okay. Yes, PrEP.
Okay.
They do provide... They have a medication... assistance program if someone isn't able to pay for it. And I believe most insurances will cover a portion of it. And then there are some other assistance programs as well.
So usually the barrier for people, it is expensive, but it's getting them to access those resources that are available. Just handing them a prescription doesn't mean they will actually get it filled. And I've seen a number of cases of failure because they never picked up the prescription because all those dots weren't connected.
Yeah.
So it's important for whoever's giving the prescription to probably have some discussion about costs and alternative methods to pay for it and explain this is worth the effort here and cost.
Yes.
It's the same with our people living with HIV and AIDS, the same thing, the importance of staying on their regimen to keep the virus suppressed. But we all know, you know, if you've ever taken a 10-day prescription, it's sometimes hard. So these people, you know, have to be on this for the rest of their lives. So, and the CDC push is really to get everybody taking their medicine on a regular basis so we keep this virus under control and so it's not transmitted. But that's often easier said than done, you know.
So that's what we've been discussing briefly is PrEP. That's pre-exposure, giving the medication to people who might be at risk, who do not have it, to keep them from getting infected. There's also a post-exposure methodology to try to prevent acquiring it once you've had risk, and that's called PEP. What's the difference? Who should be taking the PEP?
So PEP is more for a one-time exposure, either occupational, like through a needle stick, or some other blood exposure, or sexual exposure. Say somebody has an unknown partner in a high-risk group, or condom breaks with their positive partner, or various other circumstances, they can take post-exposure prophylaxis for 28 days to greatly decrease their risk of getting infected. The important thing to know about that is three drugs, and the sooner you start it, the better, so ideally within 4 hours. And after 72 hours, you know, the efficacy drops off over time. So after 72 hours, it's not thought to really be very helpful. So, you know, we do see gaps in that where people do know about PEP, but it's been delayed because they think they need to go see a specialist or something to get it started. And ideally, we start it often in the emergency room, give them 3 days worth with a follow-up, some sort of connection with somebody to determine whether they really did have a high risk and whether they should continue the full 28 days.
How safe? How effective?
It's safe. You know, once again, it does have occasional side effects, and usually those are nausea and GI side effects. But it's safe. It's the same thing we treat HIV people with. It's particular medications, but on that short a term, there's no real risks, no major risks.
And how does a person know, you know, I forgot, I guess I didn't do enough on the testing, but let's say we do a test after a post-exposure and you start some treatment. How long does it take to be fairly certain that an infection has not been acquired? I'm trying to guess, what's the timing of the testing to be relatively certain that no infection is present?
Well, I would retest somebody in a month and then again in 2 to 3 months. One thing that could happen is that if somebody is infected while and taking post-exposure prophylaxis, that it could delay their seroconversion, so it may take a little longer for their test to turn positive. But with our new testing technology, it's very sensitive, and in general circumstances, it could pick up HIV infection in as little as 2 weeks after infection. So even with PEP, by a month, it's going to pick up most infection, and by 3 months, we're going to be, you know, totally confident that they have not been infected.
And someone who comes in for testing or is doing, we didn't mention home testing. I started to ask about home testing. So maybe we should talk about home testing and the reliability of that and the need for follow-up testing.
So with those, the home kits, those can be picked up at Walgreens. They're about $50 compared to like coming into our office and getting a free test. It's basically the same test that we have. It's an OraQuick where you can use, you just take oral fluid to do the testing. So we get a lot of questions about that if someone wants to do a home test. And we typically just recommend they save the money and come in and get another test with us. But those are there is that option out there.
And if that's positive, then they would need confirmatory testing. Mm. I wouldn't say the uptake has been huge with home testing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we've really pushed it a whole lot because we really like the opportunity to be able to educate people and not, you know, have them out there with this potentially life-changing information that they may not totally understand the implications of.
And that's kind of where we fall to whenever we give our results. It's always in person and not over the phone, just because you want to be there, be able to answer questions. And
I was reading an email, and I don't know if the issue of a false negative came up, the timing. So someone has sex where they think they're at risk and maybe go and buy the product and do the test. Maybe 5 days later, it's negative. Is that a guarantee that they have not acquired HIV infection?
No, that test is an antibody test, and it's going to take at least 3 weeks up to 6 weeks before there's enough antibodies to turn that positive. So, so we don't have any testing 5 days after exposure that is going to pick up infection.
There has to be some time. So there's two tests. Antibody is a test of the body's immune system making a protein against that infectious organism. And that takes a while to gin up and can be variable. And actually, the levels can be pretty low. And so those kinds of tests may be a little bit more uncertain depending on the timing and how accurate the tests are. And then we have tests that detect the viral protein itself, which has gotten to be fairly sensitive to very low levels of amount of what's called antigen or the protein from the agent itself. But again, that can take a little bit of time for that agent to be making enough of that that antigen to so the timing of these tests becomes important.
Right, and that's called the fourth generation HIV test. That's the antigen and antibody combination. And that takes, it can start to pick up infection after about 2 weeks and can pick up maybe 60 to 80% of infections that early. So that has changed the nature of working up, say, somebody presents with acute HIV infection and they have often flu-like or mono-like symptoms, that when they actually come in for symptoms, this test is much more likely to pick up infection than the older test that had delayed positivity.
We only have about 3 minutes, and Heather or Terry, I may want to give you I think I should give you a chance to respond to an email that someone wrote in and said that they were a little bit bothered by the recommendation for PrEP for men that have sex with men, and said that you said something, I think it was you, said something along the lines, this can be used until they begin to make better choices. Do you want to expand on that? I mean, was there a misunderstanding there at all?
Well, that is the primary group because that's the major group that is getting infected. Mm-hmm. So to sort of cover those are at highest risk and some of those are going to be at low risk. It's always individualized as to someone's particular mm-hmm. situation. So that's not to say that all men who have sex with men have multiple partners. That's just kind of a broad basket to put that group in.
I like to end programs with just a rehash of the most important bits of information we want to get across, because people hear all this, the way our minds work, we're not going to remember a lot. What's the message here that's important?
Get tested.
Yeah. Where tomorrow's testing day. Yeah. It's get tested, because until you know your status.
Yeah, that's the only way you'll know. So mm-hmm. it's free.
And the reason those recommendations came along was because there was a significant number of people with no identified risk that were eventually identified because they were very ill with late stage disease. Mm-hmm. So to over-test, people will pick up those with no identified risk.
Yeah.
All right. My thanks to Terry Bramell, Heather Davis. I don't know why I'm calling you Harry today. Heather Davis and Matt Allen for joining the program this week to continue the discussion on HIV and AIDS. Join KSK on Facebook. You can find that link at our website, www.alaskapublic.org. You'll also find there a link to our Line 1 archives where you can look at previous programs. You can refer somebody to today's program, for example, to listen to it. Remember, the program does repeat tonight from 8 to 9 on KSKA as well. And you can let us know your thoughts and suggestions at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Next week, Line 1 will take a July 4th break, but will return a week after that, Monday, July 10th, with a discussion of placebo effects. Our guest is Dr. Virginia Campbell. She hosts a well-thought-of podcast called Brain Science. Why not join us at 2 p.m., repeating that same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1, Alaska Public Media. I want to thank Eric Bork, who engineered today's program, and he, in addition, is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.